Hi, I'm Philip DeJong. I'm 65 years old. Today is March 1st, 2020, and we are here at the beautiful campus of New Mexico State University at KRWG in Las Cruces, New Mexico. Today, I'm interviewing a dear friend, Jordan Woolley, and we have been lifelong swimming partners. So, Jordan...
Hi there. I'm Jordan Woolley, age 91. The date today is March 1st, 2020, and we're here at New Mexico State University. My past wife died about 2 years ago, so right now I'm just spending all my time at home alone.
Okay, hey, Jordan, I know you served during World War II, and I also know you served in the Korean War. Would you... Do you have good memories, or can you tell us some of the memories about your service in the Pacific Theater as a Marine?
Well, maybe we ought to start a little bit earlier than that.
Okay.
I could start, you know, being born and all that stuff and everything, but about the service and everything, it happened to me that happened to a lot of people that went into the service. I went into the service at the end of World War II, mainly to get the GI Bill. And everything. Also, I was talked into it, to go into it, by my friend, Don Samuel. Well, as happened probably 50% of the time, as you well know, or you can figure out already, we went down for the physical, who passed and who didn't.
How old were you?
18 at the time. We decided we wanted to go into the Marine Corps, into the aviation part of it and everything. Mm. So anyway, I joined up at that time. This would be September of 1946. Mm. Went through basic training in San Diego, California, at Recruit Depot there. While I was there, I guess we were in a, I was in a platoon of about 90 people, and for some reason, I got picked as the platoon leader for carrying the carry-on flag. So for that whole 6, 8, 10, 12 weeks, whatever it was, I was always out in front by myself. I could never see anybody around me, and I always said, oh, God, don't let me make a wrong turn. Because I, like I say, I was leading all the particular guys. The time at San Diego, I have nothing to put it by when it comes to the type of training, whether it was harder or less hard than what it had been during the physical times of World War II. In other words, we were in sort of a transition period after that and everything. But anyway, went through there. Like I say, I was the lead-on bearer of the flag and everything. And there, some of the memories are naturally basic training. You hate your superior sergeant because he's always yelling at you and someone else is always yelling at you. The only way you got around it is across the bay there where we were was the Navy training. And he would always give us permission to yell at the Navy recruits anything we wanted to. And there was sometimes some pretty good dialogue going on between the two of the groups and everything. The other thing that was interesting about it, and probably maybe the worst thing I remember about there at the recruit depot, was the force marches. The force marches were not on land as the line of asphalt or ground. They were on the sand where the beach was. And hiking in sand at a 4-4 speed and everything gets a little bit aggravating sometimes. Anyway, then we went to the firing range where we did our firing and everything to find out what kind of a rifle person we would be. I ended up being a marksman. I missed expert by 1 point. And they took me. I don't know why they were picking on me all the time, it seemed like. Anyway, I was told, okay, you will take this line over here and you will instruct these other people on how to fire. And the way to instruct them is just the way you fired, and you did a good job on it. So as the time we were there at Recruit Depot and at the firing range, I guess I was somewhat put in authority of different things, which was a surprise and everything. Racial problems in those days, I don't think there was any racial problems that we really noticed or anything. There were no African Americans in our platoon. We had some Spanish Mexican people and everything, and we had one Mexican kid that, and this could be any nationality would do it. He didn't want to conform with normal regulations, like taking a shower every day. So there was a couple of times when we actually had to get him in there and scrub him down with a brush, you know, to get him going and everything. So anyway, we got through Recruit Depot, graduated and everything, and then I was assigned to Miramar Marine Air Corps base there. At that time, I was put there. Maybe a lot of this had to do because of the name of Wooley. All the things were laid out, and by the time they got to the W's, they didn't have anything left to make you do. So they'd improvise and put you into these different things. So when I got to Miramar, I ended up as a gopher. And I don't know whether people know what that means, but it means you go for this and you go for that, and you're the poor victim that does all of the walking around and doing things. And I was put as a gopher for the commander of the air base there at Miramar. And my duties were at different times to drive him around, to go out and pick up colonels and generals that came in at the field and bring them over to him and everything. So I did that for, I don't remember, quite frankly, how long I was there, probably a couple of 3 months. And then I was assigned to go overseas. At that time, I went to, I went to Guam, and I joined an outfit over there called MGCIS-1, Marine Ground Control Inceptor Squadron. And everything. And they originally landed in World War II on Guadalcanal. And they set up the air defenses there and everything. And believe it or not, now this was in early 1947, there were still three or four guys in there that had landed at Guadalcanal and everything. And, you know, they were the old timers and everything. And the first thing I got to be involved with them was, I remember the first night I was on guard duty. All Marines go on guard duty. I think all soldiers go on KP. But, well, that's another quick thing. I never had KP the whole time I was in the Marine Corps, which was surprising. But anyway, I had plenty of guard duty. But anyway, so the first night I had guard duty, the sergeant of the guard, I can remember him telling me, when you go wake up so-and-so, because I don't remember what shift it was, but I guess I probably had to wake him up at either midnight or 4 in the morning, do not go by the head of the bunk. Go to the foot of the bunk and touch it and shake it just a little bit and say, wake up. And I thought, well, that's sort of weird, but I guess that's the way he wants me to do it. So I did it. So anyway, I went in there, and I can remember that to this day. I went in there and shook the bottom of the book and a bunk, and I said, wake up, it's time to go on duty. And the next thing I know, he was sitting up in bed with a pistol in one hand and a knife in the other hand looking around. He'd been in Guadalcanal so long that anything that touched him, you know, he did not like that at all. Anyway, I ended up there on Guam in the direction finding organization part of the squadron. First, MGCIS squadrons were a self-contained organization. We had our own doctors, our own motor pool, our own food and everything else, because our job was to set up air bases on different islands and everything. And like I say, some of these guys had been all through the war. There was one guy that was with me, and this is sort of digressing. I'll jump around a little bit. He did everything in the war he was supposed to, he told me. He said, never had a problem, but we landed on Oklahoma. He said, well, that's enough of this so-and-so. I won't say the words, but I'm going to take some beer in this time, so we had plenty of beer to drink. So he took a, he said he put two or three cases of beer and put it in the Amtrak, that the thing that, not the Amtrak, but the unit that they landed in and everything. And he says, I got about 50 yards from the beach, and it blew up underneath me. They hit it with a shell. So it doesn't do you any good to try to get away with stuff. But anyway, but this is what these guys, there was a lot of them there. The commanding guy, Willie P. Mitchell, he'd been in World War, all of it. He flew an F-4U fighter. He'd had a couple of planes. He'd shot down three or four planes and everything. And his fame to glory was, and it was a joke in the outfit, that he cracked up more planes landing on carriers and on bases than he did shot, and then he shot down, just because he was such a hot pilot and he landed everything. And even at that time, he was getting ready and he wanted to go into the new area, and the new area was helicopters. They were starting to become popular and everything. So anyway, I ended up there being with the directional finding thing. We had two sections in this. We had a radar section that did distance searching for radars or for planes and stuff like that. And then we had directional finding equipment, which I had, which sent out a signal, a homing signal, and it was sort of like Doppler and everything. It would come back, and that would tell the plane where the island was. Because I guess out in the Pacific, if you miss the island, you got a problem. You know, there's no place much swimming to land except there in the ocean and everything. So anyway, we were out at a Rody Point, which was out on the, I can't say what now, whether it's the north, south, east side of the island. I really don't remember. But it was at one end of the island, there were still Japanese on the island that were surrendering and everything, and we set up our equipment there, and I guess maybe 100 yards from where we were set up was a bank where it went down to the ocean, and there was nothing but old trucks, cars, bombs, and everything else where they had dumped everything off. Another thing that was fun at Rody Point was that between the point, there was the little island that was maybe 100 meters from the thing, and there was a waterway that went between it, and we used to go swimming there all the time. So I mean, really, it was a fun time and everything, and we did all the typical things. We built the fancy outhouse with the palm leaves over the top of it and everything, and we always had a gallon pot of coffee boiling and everything. So anyway, we stayed there for, about a year. I made side trips from there to Saipan, which was interesting because the airfield there at Saipan was not flat. It was like a rolling hill. So the planes had to learn to take off on the up thing, not on the down slope and everything. And there were still plenty of the Japanese there on that island and everything, and went and saw the places where they all committed suicide during World War II when they were overrun. And naturally, we went swimming there, too. There was caves you could go swimming in. So it was a fun time. After about a year on Guam, we got orders to go to China. We went to Tsingtao, China. It's not called Tsingtao now. I don't remember the name of what it's called now. It's like most of the big towns in China were renamed after the communists took them over. Anyway, we set up an airfield there and everything, and we did physically the same thing, set up the radar, set up the radio communication and everything. And China was a wild place to go. It was, well, to me, a little old San, I was born and raised in San Francisco area. To me, it was a completely different thing to what I was used to. Guam wasn't that different, but China, I mean, just seeing all the Chinese wandering around doing nothing and everything. And I remember going from the air base into the town, which was not a shock, but everything, but it was funny. You'd see all the little kids up to about 5 or 6 years of age going to the bathroom. And they didn't have any back of their pants. They just had a slit back there. And anytime they wanted to go to the bathroom, they just stopped beside the road and they went and everything. So, you know, these were different things. And the food area there, you couldn't see what the food was for the bugs and the ants and the flies and everything on it and everything. So it was a really a different outfit. While we were there at China, while we were there at Tsingtao, a couple of things happened that were interesting. One, the squadron of the airplanes that were there adopted this little kid, which I happened to bring some paperwork here and here. We called him Charlie Two Shoes. He was about, 10 years old, and they adopted him and everything. And to go into his story, after we got run out and everything, they left money there for him to go to school. He was interned in a camp there because he'd been familiar with the Marine Corps people by the communists and everything. And the squadron of the people that had him worked with the Senate, the United States Senate and Congress, and got him into the United States. And he ended up in North Carolina opening a Chinese restaurant. And then they went through it again, and they got him citizenship. And he was Charlie Two Shoes. And I found all this out about him later because they had articles on him in Parade Magazine, the Reader's Digest, and everything else. So it was really interesting. I guess the other thing that happened there is the Chinese Air Force. This was General Chiang Kai-shek's Air Force and everything. They got run out of Peking in those days, Beijing now, but Peking then, and the northern provinces and everything, so they landed at our airfield. Well, there was a problem. They spoke one dialect of Chinese, and the guy that was in the control tower spoke another dialect. Mm. So they couldn't land. They couldn't get information, so one of the fighter pilots landed and then got up in the tower, and by the time they had finished landing, they had cracked up about 30 planes. And I don't know, there was probably 100 or so planes, because I had pictures of them at home, all the World War II early planes and everything, and also chunks of burnt bodies laying all over the place from this and everything. So anyway, it was a interesting and eye-peeling type of thing. Anyway, then in, I guess the end of 48, somewhere around in there, we had to leave because the communists were starting to knock on our door. So we gathered everything, us, and did a control retreat, I guess you could call it. That's one of the famous words in the Marine Corps. You don't retreat, you do a controlled retreat. And everything. And so we left and got to the ship, loaded everything on the ship and everything. Didn't have any really physical contact with the communists. We could see them and everything, but we had no shooting with them or anything. And we got out of there and got on this troop ship. And one other thing that was interesting that happened there. We had radar coverage of Port Arthur, which was the Russian area up north. And one day, we kept seeing these bogies, as they called them, on the radar screen coming down and then disappearing. And then they'd start up again and come down and disappear. And, well, we didn't really know what they were. So we made the people aware of what was going on and what we picked up and everything. And so they believed them and believed us enough in what we were seeing that all the ships in the harbor, and there was probably about 10 or 15 ships, they were everywhere from aircraft carriers to medical ships, cruisers and everything else, started getting ready to leave in a hurry. So, you know, they were all ready to leave. They brought up steam and everything. And so they sent a couple of pilots up to fly up north to see what was going on. And that's the main reason why the squadron was there, was to show that we had control of the sky in that area for the Russians, against the Russians. Anyway, they flew up there, and they found out what it was. It was flocks of geese that had been landing in water, lakes and everything, and the lakes had a lot of minerals in them, and the minerals were sticking to their bodies a little bit. And so we were picking it up on radar and everything. So I guess we felt proud about it, and then we felt sort of like idiots, but, I mean, it showed that we were doing our particular job at the time and everything. So anyway, we got on the troop ships, got to Japan, stayed in Japan 3 or 4 days, and that was the thing there. The only thing that happened there that was interesting was the ship that we were on had our planes parked on it and everything. It was a small aircraft-type carrier and everything, and they couldn't park us right into the harbor because there wasn't any tugboats or anything. So they made the pilots start up the planes and rev the engines up, which made Willie P. Mitchell, our commanding officer, about as mad as anybody could be because they were running the engines in the F-4Us by revving up high and everything. Well, anyway, we got settled there and everything. So then we were there a couple, 3 days. So then we took off for the United States. We picked up a new major that was our new squadron officer because, like I say, Willie P. Mitchell wanted to go and become a helicopter pilot. So there was this other guy that had been around, and nobody thought much about it. He was just another officer, you know, another commanding officer. Well, we got about halfway to Pearl Harbor, and the guys were doing guard duty. All of a sudden, this guy wanted to jump overboard. And as we said in those days, he'd gone Asiatic, you know, and everything. And, you know, we didn't think much about it and everything. He said, I'm not finished fighting these Japs. We're going to take care of them and everything. Well, we found out later that this guy, and which makes the story really interesting, at least for me, was at Midway and all of the islands, and he was the commanding officer of the dive bombers and the torpedo bombers that were in the movie Midway. And he was the major that were the officer in that the story was all about and everything. And he'd had 2 complete squadrons completely shot out from underneath him, and he was the only one alive that was left alive and everything. So that's why he was sort of flaky in his thing. So anyway, we got back to California, landed at San Francisco area, and I got discharged. And so then I said, well, what am I going to do? Well, the first thing I did was use my GI Bill. And the famous part of the GI Bill that most people used in those days was called the 5220 plan. And I don't know how many people have heard of that. I'm sure all the veterans of World War II have. The 5220 plan was you got $20 a week to live on for 52 weeks. And that was a way to survive and everything. I went to Phoenix College for about 6 months to try it out. And then I got called back for active duty. At active duty, I went to El Toro, and I was sent. I was a staff sergeant then, and we were down at Miramar, and I was in MGCIS-7, which was the later of the same type of squadron, and everything. And I was picked to go to the air base there in Mississippi. Oh, gosh, all of a sudden I lost my mind. With Keesler Air Force Base. And I was from the West Coast, and then I was the staff sergeant, and then there was this tech sergeant from the East Coast. And we were sent there to learn a new ground control approach equipment that would automatically land planes, but the pilot could shut his eyes and the plane would be guided down, and he, you know, it was in fog and stuff like that and everything. So we were there for about, maybe 4 or 5 months. And it was a pretty rough time. I mean, we had class in the morning from 5 to 1. And then from 1 to 6 o'clock, we laid on the beach. And from 6 o'clock to midnight, we went out and played hanky-panky and got up the next night and got up the next morning and went back to school and everything. So it was a pretty rough time. Also, being we were in the Marine Corps, the Air Force wanted us to teach the people there that were Air Force recruits how to march and everything, so we had to do that. At that same time, McCarthy was in thing talking about the communists, and something came up, and I don't remember what it was, and the whole base was put on restriction. They could not leave. Well, they wrote the order wrong. They said all Air Force personnel are on restriction and cannot leave the base. So we're tough guys. So we went up to the gate. The guy says, you can't leave. And I said, read the order. It doesn't say anything about Marines can't leave. And we walked out. So we had a lot of fun there and everything. We came back after we finished that and everything. I went to El Toro and set up the equipment there and everything. And it was new type of radar and everything where it had the capabilities of fading out solid targets. In other words, if you had a mountain range behind you, you could fade that out and it didn't show on the screen. And why? It was just sort of a safety type of thing and everything. So we were at El Toro and we did the landing there of planes. Thank God we never lost a plane into the mountains or anything. And it worked out real good. We learned all that and everything. So came about, 6 months after that or something like that. Guess what? I got discharged again. So basically, that was most of my military stuff. And like I said, most of the military stuff was because I was chintzy in my thoughts about it. That, hey, the GI Bill sounded like a good thing, and I did use it. I used it for school. I used it to buy a house. I think one of the things that sort of tilted me to going into the service, my senior year in high school, every summer, junior, sophomore, and senior, I would work up at Lake Tahoe, which is in Central California, and One year I worked at the Hotel Tahoe Tavern, and it was one of the big hotels there. It's no longer there. In those days, it was $200 a night. This was back in 42 and 43, and it was where all the Hollywood stars went and spent their times, and I was in charge of the pantry there. Serving the desserts and making coffee and everything else. And if some of those people knew how the desserts were made, I don't think they would have liked to eat them. There was times when ice cream scoops dropped on the floor and you just pick them up and put them back in the dish and everything. Anyway, that went on. The chef that we had was a famous chef from France and everything. So we had a lot of fun there. All the people around there liked the workers because my time and hours and everything were from, 7 in the morning, 6 or 7 in the morning till 9 and 11 till 1 and then maybe 4:30 to 6:30 or 7 at night. So all the rest of the time was laying around on the pier and swimming and doing all this other stuff and everything. But anyway, I guess my most memorable thing about that was we used to all get together down in what really wasn't a bar area. It was just sort of an area where all the younger kids stayed and everything. And the manager came up to me one day, and or one evening, I guess it was, and said, "Jordan, are you doing anything tonight? Can we use you? We need a fourth for a party of some people that are bowling." And I said, "Oh, yeah, sure, that's no problem." So I went over there, and they introduced me, and here I was bowling with Edward G. Robertson, the big movie star. And that was exciting because he didn't bowl with a doodly-doodly. He would take the ball with two hands and sort of throw it on the alley, and it'd go bouncing down and everything. But anyway, that was probably my most main thoughts about that, other than hiking around and doing different things. You'd get one day off a week, and most of the time in those days you'd hitchhike. And I remember one time I was hitchhiking, and this Cadillac stopped and picked me up, and I got in. This gal was driving it. You know, we started talking. I said, "Gee, you got a license plate that says Nevada number one. How come you got such a low license plate?" And she says, "Well, I guess it's because the governor's my husband." You know, so you never know who you were going to run into. Life was completely different in those days and everything. And I did other things in those days, sort of digressing a little bit. Probably I was 13 or 14, and we had some property up in Sacramento. And I decided I had $10 in my pocket. Well, I'm going to take a trip. And I told my folks, I said, "I'm going to hike up to Mount Lassen," which was about 3 hours up in Northern California. You know, so I took a sleeping bag, my $10, and took off, you know, and hitchhiked all the way up there. I didn't have to spend hardly the $10 because the sheriff's department were always picking me up and wanting to know what I was doing. You know, and I said, "I'm just taking a week's vacation, hiking around." And they said, "Oh, fine, well, let's buy you breakfast." So they'd buy me breakfast. And I'd sleep beside of the road every night in the woods somewhere and everything. I don't think they do that much anymore. You know, I think it's a little. But anyway, so I did that 2 years. Oh, we're getting close to the end. Okay. Anyway, I did that for 2 years. And then the last year I was at Fallen Leaf Lake. And at Fallen Leaf Lake, all the people that I worked with were military men that had been discharged, because this was the summer of 46. And I was there working with guys. There's one guy, he was a lieutenant commander. He was executive officer on a submarine in the Japanese theater of war the whole year. And then another couple of guys were pilots, Air Force pilots and everything. And they were around. Back from flying, oh, I forget how many missions and everything. So I got used to being with them and everything. And I had a very simple job there. Every Friday night, we'd go out and have a big party at this other cabin, which was up the lake. And I was in charge of getting the boats up there and back because I didn't drink. So after they'd had their big wild parties up there, I'd tie ropes to the boats and chug back with the boat motor back to where we worked and everything. So, you know, all in all, it's been a good life. I got out of the service, went to work for IBM, worked for IBM for 35 years servicing computers, and got into swimming, done a lot of swimming, master swimming throughout the world and everything. And my friend here that's interviewing me or talking to me, Philip, he is also a swimmer. And so we got together. Am I running out of time?
No, you got plenty of time. Say something about your swimming career and the places you went with your with Marion.
Well, we finally, for some reason, we got the common sense in our noggins that, hey, when we go somewhere to go swimming, let's do something else other than swimming. So we'd stay around towards the latter part for an extra week and visit and everything. Places we went swimming were Rio de Janeiro. Swam there, the ocean swam, got first in it. And it was most of these swims, as Philip knows, that are put on by FINA, the world championships every 2 years for older people, master swimming, or not older people, just master swimming, usually have 7,000 to 8,000 swimmers and everything. So it's a goodly amount and everything. They're not all at the pool at the same time. But there's that many there. And I remember the thing that hit me at Rio de Janeiro was that they neglected to tell in English how to swim the 800. And they put two starters, one at each end of the pool, to take off and swim the 800. Well, they forgot to tell people, you stay on your side of the thing. And these people got down at the other end and where we were sitting. All of a sudden, we hear these characters going, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, bang. And it was people who were swimming in the wrong lane. They'd hit head on and everything. But anyway, we went there. We've been to Perth, Australia, been to Italy, England, where else? Those are the main things, United States for those. Other swim meets, we've been to New Zealand, been to Denmark, Sweden, Finland, places like that and everything. And we went to a small meet at Denmark, and it was sort of a thrill because we were the only Americans there. And you'd get on the starting blocks, and you'd look at the flags at the other end. There was the American flag right in the middle. And they didn't give medals there for winning the races. I think between Marion and myself, we won in our age group 12 races. We won first in everything. Mm-hmm. And they gave liter bottles of wine. So guess who were the most popular people in the area and everything. And so all in all, it was fun. Some of the places we went to, oh, we also went to Casablanca, Morocco, and everything. I guess the main thing I remember there was that going out to eat now and then at McDonald's, sitting there every same time we seemed to eat there, there was this same family eating there. There was a grandma that was in her habit, and all you could see was her eyes. There was the mama that had on a scarf and everything else, and then there was the baby that had on a Mickey Mouse shirt. So you really had the three different generations of the Moroccan people and everything. And that was interesting. The quick thing on that was, we did a 6-mile swim in the ocean on that, and everybody had yellow caps on, and the buoys where we had to turn around were yellow, so you didn't know whether you were following a cap or the buoys and everything. And my wife didn't finish it. She got tired, so she went to a shore, and she landed where all of the kings and their entrepreneurs, women, were there, all in their swimming habits, and she came in her swimming suit, which was sort of a shock to them, I guess, and everything. But all in all, no, I can't complain. I think I have had a wonderful life, a life that has been very fulfilling, and I wouldn't change a minute of it and everything. I had three wonderful women in my life. I had my mother who taught me opera and stuff like that. I had my first wife, who were still great friends and everything, who we raised the family with. And then I had Marion, my second wife. Each of those wives, we lived together for 30 years. And my second wife, Marion, she was a swimmer. And so we had a real great together time and everything. So all in all, you know, I look back on it, and I think I've been very blessed. I talk to some people my age, and they sound like it's awful. But no, I have nothing to complain about. And I've met wonderful people except for one, Philip, but that's here and there.
Torture every morning.
How are we doing there? We getting out of time? Anyway, I think it's very enjoyable to be able to yak about memories and everything. And I want to thank KRWG and Philip for setting this up for me and everything. I've been a member of KRG ever since it started. That's been, what, 50 years now, I think.
1922.
When I was out of White Sands and everything. So it's been a wonderful place and everything. How much more do I got to talk? I'm done. I'm dismissed. We can go home. Did that get enough through to you and everything?
Pretty cool.
I didn't know whether she was shaking yes or no. You can't say that.
I'm going to hit stop, and then we're going to take 10 seconds of
silence. Okay.
Okay.
You didn't take any.
I didn't charge this thing. Doggone it.
Oh.